Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Hey folks, welcome back. Oof, November. SPGN Journal Club for November. What happened to 2025? Gray, wet. Except if anybody is listening to the Southern Hemisphere, then enjoy your spring. What can I tell you? Have you got a nice cup of tea ready, sitting beside you? No? Well, go make one, and while you're doing that, we'll start to get ready with Dr. Jake Mann to address the two articles that he's chosen for today. The first, by Anuti et al., from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition, writing from several USA institutions, is titled Pediatric Liver Transplant Outcomes, a Comparative Analysis of Steatotic Donor Grafts. That will be followed by work from Chu et al. In Southern California, Los Angeles, as published in Hepatology Communications, Ultrasound of the Rectus Femoris as a Novel Tool to Measure Sarcopenia in Pediatric Chronic Liver Disease. I felt rather relieved on leafing through these articles to say I see no evidence whatsoever that DNA is mentioned. So, but even if the authors didn't squeeze cells and look at the juice, the statistics are kind of scary deep. But that's what Jake is here for. Jake, given that donor livers are growing fatter, the proportion of livers in which steatosis precludes use as an allograft may be increasing. That's the premise from which Anuti et al. Begin. Adding to this, of course, is that we've never had too many donor livers. So they pose this question. Are outcomes in children substantially worse with fatty allografts than with lean allografts? A USA liver transplantation database covering the 20 years between 2004 and 2024 tells us that 595 children and adolescents received liver allografts that were considered steatotic. On what basis? We're not quite sure. In 62, that is 10.4%, steatosis affected more than 30% of parenchyma. Again, how that was assessed, we're not quite sure. Those recipients, in terms of 1, 5, and 10-year survival at least, fared no worse than did the other 533 with steatosis that affected less than 30% of parenchyma. This differs from what is observed in adults who tolerate fatty implants poorly. In children, however, other factors conferred adverse prognosis, and if those factors are borne in mind and measures to address them are taken, the authors propose that fatty donor livers may be more widely usable and may be more widely used than is now the case. Jake, have I got the gist of that for the listeners?
Absolutely. The short summary is that based on this analysis and the data that they presented here, they found no significant differences based on the description of steatosis of less than 30% or over 30% in a donor graft. And that didn't matter whether they were looking at split livers or whole livers in a pediatric population.
Well, I guess that's good news. I guess it expands the donor pool somewhat. But I do have some questions about the data on which the study is based and on whether the data are so reliable as one would like. Just for curiosity's sake, I don't think we're told how many pediatric liver transplants took place overall during those 20 years. Are we?
Not that I could see. I mean, clearly the numbers that are... Oh, I can see 10,244 transplants were performed.
10,000 pediatric liver transplants and 600 of those were used fatty livers?
and of which, well, here they've reported 62 using fatty livers and 533 using non-fatty livers. And it was the remaining that there was no data. So we have quite a big gap in the total number of transplants, as in a massive gap. It is in 10,000 or odd pediatric transplants, and there was only 6% of the transplants did they have data on whether or not that there was steatosis reported. Now, I assume that that is a histological report that came from the donor, the donor material, presumably a separate section taken. I'm not sure whether that was taken at the time of retrieval or at the time of implantation. But either way, they only had 6% of the total number of grafts that they have the data on. Still, it is a reasonable number of transplants that they have data on. And they do demonstrate that they have data spanning from 2005 all the way up to 2024. So it obviously is biased, but I don't know if it's enough to totally invalidate their results.
I'm not seeking total invalidation. I'd be very happy just to sap at the foundations. That would be. Jake, here's a question. You know, I love my clinical colleagues. I really do. I think, and sometimes they strike me as so sweetly innocent. I am ready to believe that some of these assessments of steatosis were based on a sonogram. And not to say, and for the authors not to have said, yes, this is based on histopathologic evaluation of material taken, seems a gap in the paper to me.
It would seem like an important piece of evidence, given that that is the fundamental distinction between cases and controls.
Another thing that interests me is, here you are, you're a surgeon, you're evaluating the liver that is about to be implanted in your patient, and you say, you know, this is just too dodgy. Okay, we'll get a histopathologist in. And then how many biopsied livers were discarded rather than implanted? I mean, it would be useful, I think, to set this in a bit broader, a bit deeper context, to say to what extent is unsuitability of a liver as a result of steatosis a problem in liver transplantation. I don't think we have a handle on that.
Yes, I think that there is significant potential for almost a kind of survivorship bias to this data, that the steatotic grafts that were implanted were the steatotic grafts that got to the point of being implanted. And the surgeons, I at least only know from what they do here, it is clearly a multifactorial assessment as to whether or not they decide to use a graft or not, which takes into account many, many factors. Of course, when they actually get the graft and receive it, then they can make a final judgment on the degree of steatosis or not, as well as other anatomical considerations. But age and their history and their peak liver enzymes and the potential warm ischemic time and DBD versus DCD, all of these factors will play into the mix. And part of me just wonders whether these grafts that were steatotic were ones that the surgeons perhaps didn't suspect were going to be that steatotic at the time of accepting the graft. And then perhaps only subsequently on the histopathological report did they identify that the graft was more steatotic than they had perhaps anticipated.
So that the livers that were called steatotic here were actually the best of the bunch in terms of perceived steatosis.
I mean, that's complete speculation. Like, I've got no evidence to base that on other than it just... we can't extrapolate this to say, well, take any steatotic liver graft and shove it into a kid and they'll be doing just fine, because that is not...
There's more to it than that.
There's much more to it than that. And I think the point about whether the grafts are assessed by a histopathologist at the time of retrieval and or immediately prior to implantation is a really good question. I don't know what the standard practices are in the US. I think that, as far as I'm aware, in the UK, it would be uncommon to have a histopathologist present to assess the graft. More typically, the surgeons will make a multifactorial macroscopic assessment and then, based on that, would decide whether or not to potentially proceed.
I certainly got called in at King's often enough in the middle of the night.
Okay.
But maybe all the grafts just rolled downhill until they finally rejected elsewhere, wound up at King's. Who knows? Who knows? In any event, survival rates in children who receive non-steatotic livers. Okay. What we have is we have livers that were assessed as steatotic, less than 30% and more than 30%. And then out of that 10,000 plus, we're assessing only 650 or something like that. Is that right?
Correct.
So there's another, you might say, a control group of presumably non-steatotic, but who the hell knows?
I think it's certainly the latter. We have no data on what whether who was what from that other 9,450.
I admire the way you're able to do sums in your head, Jake. But so 9,450, we've got a firm number now. I would have liked to see survival statistics in those kids, just to be sure that there wasn't, again, some sort of bias in selecting the kids who eventually were tagged as steatotic.
Yeah. For example, was there a reason that the histopathological report came through to the UNOS data system for those 650 kids that are reported here versus those that where it wasn't reported? Is there some other inherent difference? Perhaps it's a center thing that some centers reported and some don't. That is quite possible. But I guess the other factors that they do implicate in survival kind of makes sense. So the strongest factor they show is if they're a DCD donor after deceased, after cadaveric death donor, that they have a poorer survival, and that makes sense. The donor age is positively associated with risk of mortality, again, which makes sense. And then also the need for, or the duration of life support that the recipient had needed was associated with death, which obviously makes sense. The other kind of thing that does again point towards consistency with the data, and the only shred that suggests that steatotic grafts were not so good, was that they had a longer stay in hospital if you received a steatotic graft, which would suggest that the graft probably didn't quite get going.
A couple of hiccups before it decided to sit up and get out of bed. Okay.
Something like that. And again, it just makes me wonder whether we're seeing the best of the steatotic grafts in this data set.
Okay. Jake, we need to journey on to the article about sarcopenia. And they offered the results of imaging study work that's intended to assess muscle bulk and consistency, that is fibrosis or fatty infiltration, in pediatric patients with chronic liver disease. Growth failure is not always reflected, Chuidol say, in pediatric end-stage liver disease scores that are used in selecting children for liver transplantation. And children not listed for transplantation but with growth failure not infrequently die while waiting for an organ. So how do you assess frailty and sarcopenia in juggling children up and down the transplantation list? I don't know what you can do about frailty, but sarcopenia assessment qualitatively and quantitatively could be some place to start. And Chu et al. Subjected the rectus femoris, right and left, to ultrasonography because that muscle is easy to find and easy to scan. They found that their measurements were internally consistent and observer consistent, and that those results correlated well with clinical findings and clinical laboratory biomarker values. Another tool for transplant teams to use. Are you going to be taking this on board, Jake?
I think that this is a interesting, promising preliminary piece of work. Not that the work that they've reported is a complete piece of work, but they haven't yet attempted to address the real crunch questions of whether these measures of sarcopenia based on rectus femoris ultrasound correlates with risk of death from liver disease or waitlist mortality or survivability post-transplant. Those are clearly they're very difficult questions to answer, and the data that they've presented here is the first step to doing those studies. But we're not yet at a point of saying, well, let's scan these kids' quads and then decide on whether or not they've got really bad liver disease, and these go to the top of the list.
That is pretty much their goal, wasn't it? Or at least in shifting the kids with fibrosis or fatty infiltration up a notch on the transplantation list.
I think that's their long-term vision, as they outline in the introduction. But the... Mm-hmm. The short-term comparison here that they've done in a substantial number of children, 156, was compare healthy with those with liver disease. And the patients with liver disease in general did not have end-stage liver disease. Their definition of chronic liver disease was someone who'd had an ALT of greater than 2 times the upper limit of normal for more than 2 months with mm-hmm. a primary liver disease. And I think about half of their chronic liver disease group had advanced fibrosis. So half did not have advanced fibrosis. So these aren't the sickest of liver patients. But even despite that, they have shown differences that seem biologically plausible.
Okay. So, Jake, they correlated these with biomarker values, didn't they?
Yes. So in the first instance, they certainly correlated them with our standard metrics that we would use for assessment of body composition and nutritional states. So height Z-score, BMI Z-score, mid-arm, upper arm circumference, where the MUAC or MAC, however you want to call it, the mid-upper arm circumference, is a decent measure because it is unaffected by ascites, spleen mass, liver mass. And in general, they showed a positive correlation between most of the metrics of the rectus femoris with both BMI and MUAC.
But they didn't go on to correlate these with adverse outcome or good outcome.
Not with adverse outcome or good outcome, correct. There was some correlation with degree of fibrosis for many of the markers. I guess the threshold that you would need to pass in order to say, well, is this a tool we want to use, is is this ultrasound better than MUAC or BMI for assessment of growth failure? And that is what I think they would need to demonstrate in order then to be able to argue that this is a marker of growth failure independent of these other metrics that we typically use that would allow a child to be prioritized on their list.
Well, there's no harm in getting in viewing it from a third perspective, is there?
No, and I think that that is the potential benefit of this tool, and it's not invasive. It is, I think, probably comparatively straightforward, and I imagine well tolerated. There's, I guess, one interesting bit that I don't entirely understand what it means is, but the echogenicity of the rectus femoris seems to behave in a different way, is in their data, it behaves differently to all of the other metrics. So, for example, almost all their metrics in terms of surface area and mass and fascicle length correlate with BMI and mid-upper arm circumference, whereas the echogenicity does not. And yet they found that the echogenicity was correlated with the probability of having chronic liver disease, but I think only on the right side, not the left side, which doesn't entirely add up, because you'd imagine that that was relatively similar. But then there is a legness, that the propensity of whether you are likely to kick a ball with your right or left leg that could influence some of these data.
Jake, that sounds suspiciously like a call for further funding and further research.
Yeah, I think to me this seems like what I would love to see now is a similar study done in 100 kids who are on the wait list, who have significant end-stage liver disease, and then see if it correlates with outcome.
Well, as always, Jake, from your lips to God's ears, and for podcast listeners, those who take part in this podcast, either as listeners or as broadcasters, certainly are closer to God than the average pediatric gastroenterologist. Jake, thanks for another good session.
Thanks, Alex. Speak soon.